The Writer's Voice. To celebrate our 30 years of service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work. The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.
I'm Patty Campbell, your host for the program, and today I'm very pleased to welcome Ellen Robertson. Ellen is with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and you'll recognize her name because for 30 years, Ellen has included writing obituaries in her many Times-Dispatch duties. And Ellen, actually, I guess I couldn't say Times-Dispatch duties for the whole 30 years, could I?
No, I started with the Richmond Newsleader, actually.
And moved over to the Times-Dispatch?
I did, when the merger came about.
You said when I called you and asked you to come on this program that it was fairly unusual for someone to still be writing obituaries 30 years later, but you've done that through choice.
I have. Obits is usually considered a novice desk, and you come in and you learn you learn to write obits. Obits is a very detailed desk, so you learn to you know, get the name of the person right, you get the age right, you look up the occupation, the name of the firm to make sure it's right, and you learn all this wonderful detailed information and how to get it, and then you move on. I didn't.
Well, what you're describing sounds very formulaic, but when we read your obituaries, they aren't at all formulaic. Were they in the beginning, and how did the change come about?
Extremely formulaic. And it's taken a career to really get obits to blossom. In fact, I have an example here of a typical obit, and I chose this one. I sort of found this by accident. It's for a man named Earl David Powers, who was one of 21 children. And I have a contrasting obit for his sister that I didn't write Earl David Powers' obit, but I did write his sister's later on. And there's just a world of difference.
Will you read both of them to us and sort of talk us through those differences?
I will. We also didn't get bylines in the early days either, so I have no idea who to give credit, but for whoever it was perfect for the time. Earl David Powers, retired State Division Manager of Buildings, Supplies, and Motor Equipment for Chesapeake and Potomac Telephone Company of Virginia, died today in a local hospital. He was 63. He had been hospitalized for several weeks after surgery for stomach cancer. Mr. Powers, who lived at 2106 Millbank Road, we used to include addresses too, joined CNP as a lineman in June 1941. He rose to supervise foreman in his division and then served as a district staff manager for Atlantic Telephone and Telegraph Company in New York for 3 years. He was named division manager in February 1982. When the Bell divestiture came, he was put in charge of real estate transactions for CNP. He retired in June 1982. A native of Oilville in Goochland County, he was one of 21 children born to a farming family who served in the U.S. Army during World War II. He was an elder in the Melchizedek Priesthood of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He had served in the Sunday School Superintendency of the Church's Richmond First Ward and was the ward's employment specialist, helping members to find employment or upgrade their jobs. He was a life member of Telephone Pioneers of America, and then it lists a whole bunch of survivors, which was typical.
And remind me of when that was published.
All right, now this was published in February 1986. Okay. Now, I did this obit on his sister, Lydia Powers Shell, in May of 2008. 1986 was sort of a watershed for us because I wrote the first obit in which we really sort of allowed a lot of personal detail that year. It happened to be for my former boss at the Miller Rhodes Advertising Department. But anyway, let me read you the contrast. The contrast is just unbelievable. The last surviving girl of the 21 children born to the Oilville family of Thomas Eugene and Lydia Lockett Amos Powers died on Thursday. Lydia Vernell Powers Shell, known all of her life as Vernell, died in a Henrico County nursing home where she had lived since 2004. She was 92. A funeral will be held Monday at 11 at Woody Funeral Home's Parham Chapel, 1771 Parham Road. Burial will be in West Hampton Memorial Park, next to her husband, Leonard Armistead Shell, who died in 1983 after 40 years of marriage. Born March 2, 1916, she was the 13th child and 6th girl. 18 of the siblings lived to maturity. Her parents had married in 1896 when her mother was 15. There was a stillborn child born before Daisy, the first child who lived, was born in 1898. Mrs. Shell's birth followed another stillborn child, said Myrtle Leake, a niece. Mrs. Shell came into the world at home, a converted store on a 29-acre farm. The house had a large kitchen and large living room, dining room area, with a hallway that led up to three more large rooms. Upstairs, there were three large rooms, a wide hall, and an attic. Most rooms in the upstairs hall had two beds. Children in the family slept two or three to a bed, depending on their size. There was an old picture hanging up in the house of her papa's father, who had a long beard, Leake said. Vernell told her papa, "That's the ugliest old man I ever saw." He told her, "No use in saying anything. You look just like him." Thomas Powers raised everything his family ate. His money crop was tobacco, and during the winters he commuted to work at a Richmond tobacco warehouse. Money was tight, but the family was known for its generosity, said a niece, Laura Watkins of Chesterfield County. "Thomas Powers expected you to act in that home on Sunday as if you were in the Lord's house," Leake said. In 1900, the family joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They held Sunday school in their home from 1916 to 1960. "If you whispered, Papa would lower his glasses and look over them at you. He expected you to be reverent and come dressed in your best." And I won't go on with the rest of it, but you get the point. I mean, there is just so much contrast. And, you know, he was born, he was educated, he worked, he was promoted. These are the organizations. We're no longer doing the cut and paste operation of, you know, excising the name and the details and pasting in somebody else's.
It's fascinating to me, the last of 21, mm-hmm. though you had talked to two nieces. Were they your sources of information? I mean, if a person has died, how do you get the information?
Well, there are many sources, actually. Obviously, the family is your first, you know, line. But sometimes we have written about people before. So I always go into our electronic and manual library to see if I can find anything first. I like to get as much information from other sources first and then verify it with the family, because what some people's perception is of a family just isn't correct sometimes.
Now, you're talking to a family in the first hours or first day after they have lost this loved one.
That's right.
Is that difficult?
It depends on the family, really. Some people are just troopers and you can ask them anything, and other people, it takes a little bit more encouraging.
And you don't have a whole lot of time, do you, to write?
I really don't, because it's interesting. I get obits from people sometimes. I got one not too long ago, a month after the person had been buried, and they were asking us to put an obit in, and I had the unpleasant duty of saying, "This woman would have been a charming obit if I'd gotten it a month before," because we are in the news business, and obits, like any other stories, are news. And if they're not timely, they're not news.
You mentioned that first obituary that you were able to write that began to change the formula. And you said it was for someone that you had known.
It was my boss at Miller & Rhodes. I was in the advertising department there. And I knew the family really well. In fact, the son came down and talked to me for about a half an hour. And I wrote an obit that actually, Mitch was an incredibly creative person. And one of the things that his son talked about was how he had built a handicap access ramp for his chickens when they couldn't get on the front porch. And after we laughed for about 5 minutes about that, I thought, you know, that's just so Mitch. I don't know that I was really expecting to get any of some of the creative things in the OPIC, because at the time we were doing, he was born, he was educated, this was his job, these were his organizations, and this is his family, period. But we had a novice copywriter, a copy editor, I'm sorry, on the desk that night. He didn't have a clue. And I'm not sure how it got past the editors, but it did. And the copy editor would have been the last, sort of the last bastion, so to speak. And he wrote me a little note on email and asked me a question or two. And he fooled around with my lead a little bit. The chicken was no longer in, the ramp was no longer in the lead. But he kept in the personal stuff. And I was so thrilled. I mean, I ran around screaming at home, you know, it's David, it's David.
Will you share that obituary with
me? I will. I will read down to his point, because after that it gets formulaic again. Ashton Daniel Mitchell Jr. created advertisements for Miller & Rhodes and later for his own ad agency. When he needed props, he sometimes went to his own basement to create such things as giant Christmas nutcrackers, jets that could hang from the ceiling, and a Star Wars-type spaceship. His creativity extended to a painting, playing string bass in a jazz band, and building his chickens a handicapped access ramp to their roost when a chicken got hurt by a dog, a son said. The rest of it goes on pretty much like we always had, but, I mean, this was revolutionary for us.
And did it create a reaction in the newsroom?
Did. It really did. And his wife, who was public relations director for Chesterfield County at one time, called me and she said, I got a call from a man. He said, I have never heard of an obit quite like that before. And I thought, thank goodness, because no two people are the same. And no person should be, you know, put into a box, I don't think, if you're writing about them. I try to capture what the person is like. I mean, you can pretty much switch, you know, it doesn't, you write about the profession, yes, because a lot of times that's what piques the interest. But you want to know what the person is like, you know, and if you put him in a box, you make him pale to what he does, and that's not right.
Are there particularly memorable characters for you whom you met when you wrote their obituary?
Yes, there have been. Of course, I don't get to meet a lot of people. I meet families. Occasionally, I will meet somebody and write obits later on. I met someone at a funeral the other day that I know I'm going to write his obit, and I have a mental picture of that person. In fact, it was the father of a friend of mine that I went to school with, and I know I'm going to do his obit. And that's, it's vastly helpful. When I can. I'll never forget, a former mayor of Richmond came in, and his wife had died, or was about to die, I don't remember which. And he came in and he said, I'd like to give you some obit information on my wife. This is very rare, but it's very helpful when we get information ahead of time. And he said, do you have an obit prepared on me? And I said, yes, I do, as a matter of fact. And I don't usually show people the obits that I've written on them before, but it just felt right at the time. And I showed it, and he said, that's perfect.
So you do write obituaries in advance for people?
Oh, yes. That's part of the newspaper business, because there are some people that, if you'll pardon the expression, you wouldn't want to be caught dead with dying on obit deadline.
Mm-hmm.
There's just too much to do.
And those people have been too prominent or
yes,
accomplished
most
too
of them
many
been
things
very
to do.
Prominent. You have maybe governors, or you have people who are prominent in the arts community, or for whatever reason, you know, we know ahead of time that we're going to do an obit on. And so we gather our sources, and I make up little fact sheets. You know, I do the born and educated and everything, and then I try to find people in the sources that were contemporaries at the time who can give me the little colorful bits that really fill in the person's personality. And I look up the telephone number of the family, and it's sitting there waiting for us.
When the time comes. But people don't necessarily know that you're working on these things.
I think some people suspect. Nobody's promised anything, but I think a lot of people suspect. I had a professor at the University of Richmond who has sent me a CD of his fly story. First one I've ever gotten. But some people will call me up ahead of time and say, would I be a candidate? And if this person is, I'll quite joyfully say yes, because that means I will have input directly from my source, which is very rare.
You've brought some other obituaries.
I did.
What else have you brought?
Well, I tried to select some different ones. I've got a lady who was the caretaker for her aged, actually 101-year-old twin aunts. I have a Holocaust survivor who is just amazing. I have the wife of a general. You would think maybe there wasn't an awful lot to write, but she was interesting, although she wasn't prominent in the way the general was.
Can we hear those?
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to start with Nancy Baker. She was the caretaker. Nancy L. Baker loved her girls, her twin aunts, Willie Alcorn Wells and Nanny Alcorn Wright, whom she moved in with in 2001 when they were 98 years old. Ms. Baker, a retired dietitian who had lived in Florida since 1970, became their companion, chauffeur, and caretaker so that the widowed and childless sisters, who rarely were separated during their lives, could stay together in their shared Richmond home. Ms. Baker, 69, died June 30th in Richmond. In a 2004 Times-Dispatch interview, she recalled how the sisters, who were nurses, put their training to use for the family. Nanny came to Florida to take care of my mom when she was sick, Ms. Baker said. They traded off months going to care for their mother in North Carolina. They took in their 92-year-old sister and cared for her until they were unable to do it anymore. Ms. Baker kept up the family tradition. She made sure they got their favorite breakfast, buttercream coffee cake and a hot coffee, served with a morning newspaper. She took her aunts to beauty salon appointments and almost daily luncheon dates at a restaurant, where the twins ordered one entree and split it. She saw them through cataract surgery, Nanny's nasty fall and arthritis, and Willie's pacemaker. Miss Baker gently would remind her aunts not to trim the hedge or change hard-to-reach light bulbs, but kept a discreet eye on them while they continued to do what they still could do, such as washing the dishes and doing laundry. She drove them several times a year to her home in Leesburg, Florida. She took them to SeaWorld in Orlando and to celebrate Christmas with her nephew in Florida. She took them to their family farm in North Carolina and to an NSYNC concert in Washington. In 2004, she comforted Willie when Nanny died after suffering a fall not long before their 102nd birthday. Afterward, life went on as Ms. Baker took Willie to a National Twins Convention where she was celebrated as the oldest attendee. She took Willie to Nashville, Tennessee, where country music legend Porter Wagoner noted from the stage of the Grand Ole Opry that she was in attendance. By 2006, Willie, using a cane she had named for her twin, was walking ahead and opening doors for Ms. Baker, who had rheumatoid arthritis and walked with two canes. Survivors include a brother, and it goes on about the funeral arrangements. We don't often get caretakers, but this one was a pretty interesting combination.
It was really interesting.
And in a way, it's sort of a celebration of all caretakers. One of my favorite all-time ones is this one about a Holocaust survivor. I think I have a special spot in my heart for these folks because I had an honorary German grandmother whose husband and brother were in Auschwitz. So this one is about Esther Talkowska Kuttner. She was a 12-year-old Jewish girl when the tanks of Nazi Germany rumbled into her hometown of Brezhne, Poland in September 1939. She found their presence, which shook the walls of her home, exciting. She little realized the soldiers they transported would dismantle her world. uncertainty replaced the security of home as the Nazis crowded Esther, her widowed mother, brothers Lemuel and Nissan, and sister Rivka with other Jews into a ghetto surrounded by fences and guards. After German soldiers cut off her beautiful long braids for amusement, her mind railed that she had suffered the worst thing that could happen to her. She was terribly wrong. In 1941, the Nazis uprooted her family to a ghetto in Lodz, Poland. There, the Nazis demanded custody of the youngest Jewish children, saying they would be sent to a children's camp and treated well. She equipped her six-year-old brother, Nissan, with a little knapsack, made him promise to ride each week, and delivered him to the Germans. She learned after World War II that he was immediately gassed to death. When her camp closed in 1944, she and her family were herded into cattle cars, where they traveled, starved, and dehydrated. At their destination, "I saw strange buildings at the end of the world," she told journalism professor William Ruhlman in the 1970s. As he related their conversation during a speech December 9th, he quoted her saying, "I thought to myself, dear God, is this where we're going? It looked like hell." It was Auschwitz, where Dr. Joseph Mengele, the Nazi physician who would personally select 400 people to die, awaited them on the platform. "With a twist of his thumb, I was pointed in this direction, and the rest of my family was pointed in that direction. I never saw my family again," she told Ruhlman. She became one of Mengele's children, young human guinea pigs who suffered unspeakable medical atrocities as the doctor experimented to develop a pure Aryan race. She suffered interminable roll calls where Nazis counted heads, recalling especially a pre-dawn call-out when her bare feet began to freeze on the ice and snow-blanketed ground. She balanced on her right leg and lifted her left foot to protect it. Her right leg froze up to the hip and turned black. The flesh split open, exposing green, infected bone. The right leg healed shorter than the left. Pain in both legs troubled her the rest of her life. She also bore a deep scar where her flesh opened from malnutrition. A year later, with the war's end near and the Allies coming in close on the German camps, the Nazis set the Auschwitz inmates on a death march by night to Germany to eliminate witnesses to their atrocities. "If you couldn't walk, they would kill you," she recalled. She was having trouble walking. "Rather than suffer death by a Nazi bullet, she decided she wanted to die on her own terms," said her daughter, Faye Kessler of Henrico County. One night, she let a four women escape into the woods during a snowstorm. They ran and hid for days. American soldiers found her on a road in Germany, looking like a little skeleton, Ruhlman related. She recuperated in an American military hospital, where doctors saved her frozen left leg from amputation. In 1946, Esther married fellow Holocaust survivor Leo Meyer Kuttner, whom she met in a displaced persons camp in Germany. They immigrated to Richmond in 1949 with their young son Benjamin, now Bennett of Glen Allen. Two more children, son Lee Kuttner of Henrico and her daughter Faye, followed, as did four grandchildren. She lost a granddaughter to cancer in 1995. Her husband died in 2002. Though the Holocaust robbed her of much of what was dear, its horrors failed to dislodge her firm belief in the goodness of humanity, Kessler said. For two decades, she would not talk about her experiences. She wanted to protect us. Not only didn't she want us to feel her pain, she didn't want to raise us to hate, Kessler said. Then she opened up, bearing her witness to hundreds of military, college, civic, church, and school groups. She championed Holocaust education. She devoted energy to politics, PTA boards, and Jewish groups. She volunteered at hospitals and preschools. She cooked and did laundry for six neighbors. The pain of her early childhood never abated. "I have not a single picture of my family," Esther told Ruhlman. "Good Lord, what I wouldn't have given for just one." "When my oldest son got married, I did not know what was making me cry. I was weeping uncontrollably, and I was thinking, Mom's not here. This is the legacy of war." She suffered nightmares all her life until dementia set in 2 years ago. "My oldest daughter told me, if anyone on earth deserves to lose her memory, it's Nana," Kessler said. "By losing her memories, she can have peace and not be tortured by the memories of the past." Esther Kuttner died on Sunday, her 81st birthday. She was buried in the Bethel section of Forest Lawn Cemetery. She was always so grateful for the opportunities this country afforded her, Kessler said. She would never say anything directly negative about the United States. It meant too much to her. Appreciate what she's got, she'd tell us. You never know when it will change. At Jewish holidays, when they cooked the special foods, my mother and father would reflect on the times when they had nothing but a potato skin to sustain them, Kessler said. They would look at us three children and say, you have to understand how much we appreciate this. They were so glad to have raised us in this country.
Wow, that's really...
It's a huge testament to the human spirit, and there are just so many other people who have similar, you know, not necessarily as dramatic as this, but overcome all sorts of things.
We have time for one more.
All right, this is the wife of Lewis Chesty Puller, who was the most decorated Marine in the Marine Corps history. Virginia Montagu Evans of Saluda was 16, and Lewis Burwell Chesty Puller was 27 when they met at a cotillion in nearby West Point. Puller, who would become the most decorated Marine in the Corps' history, was smitten, said their daughter Virginia Dabney of Lexington. My father said that winning her hand was his hardest battle, Dabney said. For years, he'd go on Marine Corps assignments and return to Saluda to ask Virginia to marry him. She finally said yes when she was 29 and he was 40 and a Marine Corps captain. They married in a military wedding on November 13, 1937, at Christ Church. Mrs. Puller, who was widowed in 1971, died Saturday at her home in Saluda. She was 97. One of three children born to a lawyer's family, she grew up in Evans Leah, a big house in Saluda that had 52 windows, said her daughter, Martha Downs of Alexandria. She graduated in the early 1920s from St. Mary's School in Raleigh, North Carolina. She was everything he ever wanted. They were everything each other ever wanted, Dabney said. They were absolutely devoted to each other. He sent her roses all the time, and they wrote love letters. Puller did the Marine Corps. He thought it was the greatest thing and the best way to take care of us, Down said. Mother did everything else. She bought cars and houses and life insurance, and she did it beautifully. But she didn't want anyone to know she was doing those kinds of things. She wasn't sure if it was ladylike. She wanted people to think Father was doing all that. She was a genteel Southern lady, but an iron lady, Down said. If you didn't have manners when you were coming in the house, you did when you left. Mrs. Puller accompanied her husband on a tour of duty in China in 1940. She and her infant daughter, Virginia, left on the last American dependent ship before the Japanese took Shanghai in 1941 during World War II, Dagny said. She also followed him to Hawaii and across the U.S. mainland, but returned to Saluda during his combat tours in World War II and the Korean War. When he retired in 1955 as a lieutenant general, the couple settled in Saluda. She really loved the Marines, Dabney said. She fed hundreds of them. She knew how much it meant to Father. He would bring Marines home off the street if he met them at the gas station. She found Marine husbands for her daughters. At Christmas, she would be graciously serving a Southern lunch to sergeants at this end of the table and generals at that end, Down said. When my father would get tired, she would say, the general needs a nap. Mrs. Puller loved history, historical restoration projects, and going to old homes and plantations. She was a member of the Association for the Preservation of Virginia Antiquities.
We knew the general. Now we know the wife.
Yeah.
Ellen, this is really very, very, this has been very, very special. I wish we had an hour. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Patty. I appreciate your asking me.
We've been talking with Ellen Robertson and hearing the magic of a well-written obituary.
I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
Been listening to The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice.